south hoof went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. We are continuing to read from Cowboy Up, Life Lessons from Lazy Bee by H. Allen Day. This was from Morgan James Publishing in 2018 in New York City. Today we will read Part 5 on Persistence, the subtitle of which is, If Plan A Doesn't Work, Stay Calm. The alphabet has 25 more letters. This is all in a day's work. It was the first day of summer vacation. I had just returned to the ranch, having finished my junior year of high school. Claude Tippetts, one of our cowboys, must have noticed I was up for grabs. Let's you and me head over to ZBRL, he said after breakfast. There's a corral fence that needs replacing. I said, fine. If that's what needs doing, let's do it. We loaded digging equipment, a 5-gallon igloo water jug, and lunch into the pickup and drove east about 10 miles to ZBRL, an old homestead that Lazy Bee had acquired years after the place had been abandoned. A well had been drilled there about 1915, and a windmill and corrals built around the same time. The old house had been broken up board by board and used in branding and cooking fires. The big round corral fence was still standing, but the middle corral fence was falling down. All of the fence posts, most likely originals, had rotted. We spent part of the day hauling the old posts out of the way and lining up railroad ties that we would use for the new fence. Then we got busy digging post holes. We each had a shovel, and between the two of us, one heavy digging crowbar. The bar was called Big George. That's the name it always had. It was so big and heavy that if you used Big George all day, you were a man. Big George had a digging point on the end of it. What we discovered on the first hole was that after digging with our shovels through 8 inches or so of sandy soil, we hit caliche, a sedimentary rock that rivals concrete in hardness. Out came Big George. When we banged Big George into the caliche, we broke off tiny pieces of the rock, about 1/4 inch thick and about the size of a 50-cent piece. After 15 or 20 minutes with Big George, I'd be used up. While Claude took his turn with BG, I'd get down on my hands and knees, and with a tomato soup can, scoop out the flakes I had just loosened until the bottom of the hole was clean. I'd gulp some water and be ready to go at it again. Except for a quick lunch, we worked that way all day. Banging, sweating, scooping, drinking. It wasn't a race to see who could work faster. It was just steady, hot, hard work. At the end of the 8-hour day, each of us had dug a 3-foot-deep hole and drunk our half of the 5 gallons of water. We packed up the pickup and headed home. The next day we were at it again, banging, sweating, scooping, drinking, and sweating some more. The midday temp had to be at least 100 degrees. By 4 o'clock we were out of water, so we packed up. The next day, we brought the igloo and a canvas water bag. Once again, by the end of the day, we each had dug another post hole. I had a feeling Claude was satisfied with the work. Never had he said, "Golly, this is hard," or, "Wish we could go faster." He just kept working strong and steady. Being a teen and impatient, at the end of the week I finally said, "Claude, isn't there a better or faster way to dig these holes?" Claude's answer to me was as valuable as a whole semester in school. Well, what we're doing here is good, honest work, he said, leaning on Big George and wiping the sweat off his forehead. We'll finish when we finish. And when we finish this job, there'll be another job that needs doing. So let's not look ahead. Let's work at doing the best job we can right here. That way, we can rest assured that these posts will still be standing up when we're dead and gone. Standing there drenched in sweat with blistered hands, I realized that I had just learned exactly who Claude Tippetts was. How could I have anything but respect for this man who, day after day, got himself out on the ranch doing honest hard work that brought him complete satisfaction? I accepted Claude's simple and direct analysis. From that point on, I never resented having to spend each day banging on rock-hard caliche with Big George. But that didn't mean I couldn't keep an eye out for better post-hole digging technology. Several years after that summer with Claude, we had to build a whole new set of corrals at Antelope Well. It involved maybe 10 times as many post holes as we had dug at Z-Bar L. Harold Bishop, the local concrete guy in Lordsburg, had just bought a backhoe. It was the first one around, the first one any of us had ever seen. I went to Harold and asked him if his backhoe had a 12-inch wide digging bucket, because that was the size of our fence post holes. Yes, he said. I then asked if that backhoe had enough hydraulic pressure to dig through caliche. Sure does, he said. I went to Antelope Well, marked each post hole, then hired Harold and his backhoe. He dug all those holes in one day. Progress in spades. A few years after that, I bought a backhoe for Lazy B. Besides Big George, it was one of the most useful tools on the ranch. When Claude got old and retired, I'd go visit him at his little house in Duncan. One day he said in his gruff voice, "Come in here, boy. I've something I want to give you." We went into his house, and he handed me his spurs that he had used on the roundup for 50 years. "I don't think I'll need these anymore," he said. It was such a touching moment, neither of us could speak. We could only cry. To this day, I've never gotten an acknowledgement in my life that was better than that. His spurs still hang on the wall next to my front door. I always felt like I learned a huge lesson from Claude about doing the best job possible. Claude never required attention, never asked for help, saw jobs on the ranch that needed doing, and went and did them. He was grudging with his approval and rarely complimented anyone. Still, in ranch school, if there is such a thing, Claude was the teacher I never forgot, and the one who handed me my diploma, a pair of spurs. Whenever I see those spurs, I'm reminded to do the best job I can at whatever I'm doing on that particular day. When I do it, I always have a sense that somewhere above, Claude is looking down at me with approval. That was all in a day's work. And this is roping the bull. "When are you going to come get your bull? He's trampling our cotton plants and almost lives in our alfalfa." Charlie Klaus didn't sound angry, just a little frustrated. "I'd be happy to," I said into the phone. "But what are you talking about, Charlie?" Charlie owned a farm down on the Gila River across from Lazy B. "One of your bulls has been jumping the fence," he said. This was news to me. Apparently, for the past year, this bull would hightail it over the fence and maraud through the fields, crushing cotton plants, feasting on alfalfa, and making a general mess of things. Charlie would run him into the thickets by the river, where he hid until Charlie disappeared. Then the naughty guy would jump the fence again, and the cycle would repeat. "Why didn't you tell me about this sooner? I would have come and gotten him." I felt a prickle of irritation. I knew Charlie had a lousy fence that he didn't maintain. I could already tell this bull had taught himself well. He had the upper hand and was working the system. Now, we'd have to retrain him, if that was even possible. "Will you rope him if you have to?" asked Charlie. "Because that's one big sucker of a bull." "Yeah, Charlie, if I need to rope him, I will." I didn't particularly want to rope a full-grown bull, but if that were the only way to gather him, I would do it. Shooting him wasn't an option.
"Then tell me when you're going to do it, because I'll stay home from work. I want to see this one."
Oh, good grief. What were we running, a rodeo? "Stay home tomorrow, Charlie, and we'll come get that bull." If Saber had been in my string, I would have chosen him for the job. But this was the pre-Saber era, so the next morning I went out and caught Tequila, a young mare with mousy, Gruya coloring that I was riding at the time. She was Candy's older sister, but from that start was a sweet, kind gal. She had a big, solid frame and strong shoulders, and she never shied away from work. She liked to work cattle, but wasn't a top-notch cow horse or particularly athletic. We'd never been in a situation together that demanded she give everything, so I didn't know her limits. But since she was the biggest horse in my string, I chose her for the job, hoping she could handle it. I recruited Cole Webb, our foreman, and Vince Sanchez, a lazy bee cowboy, to accompany me. Cole's horse was smaller than Tequila, but I didn't think that would pose a problem. Vince would work the corral gate on foot. We saddled the horses, loaded them in the trailer, drove over to the Klaus farm, and parked near an old corral adjacent to the cotton field. The plan was to run the bull in there, then load him into the trailer. The corral was cluttered with wood and debris and had loose rub boards hanging down. I assigned Vince cleanup duty. Cole and I headed our horses out along the levee that separated the Gila River from Charlie's fields. A barbed wire fence ran the length of the levee. The ground on both sides of the fence was a mosaic of giant hoof prints. We opened a gate to get to the river, where we thought the bull might be hanging out, and left it open so we could backtrack through it. The ground had long since gulped the monsoon rains, so the slender river barely filled 1/8 of its quarter-mile bed. Thickets of scrub brush and mesquite grew in the sand, perfect hideouts for a crafty animal, not quite crafty enough to hide its trail. We followed a fresh track of prints that led straight to a thicket. There was a muted drum roll of thudding hooves, a splash of water, and a big red bull with a massive set of horns jumped out front and center about 80 yards ahead of us. Except for the tips having been cut off the horns year before, he could have been the poster bull for Merrill Lynch. He must have weighed 1,800 pounds. He glared at us defiantly, then bolted into the next thicket. He might have been all Hulk, but he was quicker than an NFL running back. Cole and I loped toward him, hoping to haze him out of the thicket. Instead, he raced downstream to the next clump of brush. We approached, and he dashed across the river and ducked behind more mesquite and tamarisk. This tacking back and forth across the Gila, with him getting the better of us, quickly grew tiresome. I decided to call a different play. I hand-signaled to Cole that I was going to slip around to the far side of the brush where the bull would exit. Cole knew the play. He stayed on the opposite side and started making a racket. The bull burst out. He looked startled to see me 20 yards away. The lid popped off the action box. Tequila charged the bull. I threw my rope, intending to rope him around the neck so I could choke him if I had to. A bull can't fight if he can't breathe. But instead, the rope pulled up around his horns. I dallied up. Tequila jammed her front legs straight out. The bull turned and headed off, dragging her 1,200 pounds like a sled in a southwestern Iditarod. 100 yards later, he stopped to catch his breath. Cole rode up on the side of him and hazed him toward the corral. For the next 20 minutes, the fight spread over the river valley. When the bull turned toward the corral, we gave him slack and followed him. Then he tired, stopped, and turned back toward us. Not what you want, a feisty bull facing you. Cole fought him until he turned toward the corral, and once again we made progress. I felt Tequila beginning to tire. I was sorry that I had roped this sucker. It was more than Tequila could handle, but she wasn't going to quit. She remained brave and stayed with the job. "Come on, girl, I can see the corral." The bull jerked the rope, and I let him pull us. "Cole, you take the rope," I yelled. It seemed like a good time to give Tequila a break. I loosened the taut rope, threw Cole the slack, and he dallied on his saddle horn. The bull must have felt the rope's tension change, because as soon as Cole dallied up, that big old lug took off, practically pulling Cole's horse on her nose. Her 900 pounds were no match for his brute strength. I could see this was a mistake. The bull climbed up the levee and veered through the open gate. Tequila and I galloped up next to Cole and reclaimed the rope. Tequila gave it her all. She grunted, tightened her shoulders, leaned back, and locked her legs. The bull slowed, but didn't stop. He was furious that he was still roped and in a fix. He hunched forward and stomped down the levee toward the cotton field. Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed a red dirt bike at the edge of the field. I could see 2 teenagers in a row of cotton hoeing weeds. They must have arrived while we were chasing the bull in the riverbed. The bull caught sight of the cycle and made a beeline for it. Tequila lost her leverage and galloped behind him. That ornery beast made for the bike as if it were a matador's red cape. One of the boys stood up and pointed.
"Hey, that's our bike," he hollered. "Leave it alone."
They started running toward it.
"Get away! I can't control him," I yelled, motioning them to turn back.
I could feel the bull's strength and determination pulling the rope. All I could do was hang on and pray he was more interested in the bike than the boys. The bull never paused. He ran right up to that motorcycle, hooked his horns under it, and tossed it in the air like it was a play toy. Everything halted. The boys, the bull, Tequila, Cole, except the bike. We watched that two-wheeler fly 20 feet in the air, then plummet toward earth. It landed with a metal crunching thud. The boys took off running in the opposite direction. Shit. They probably saved up a year's salary of cotton hoeing money to buy that motorcycle. Now, there it lay, crumpled to death. The bull shook his head and snorted and stomped a few times. Tequila raised her head. She wasn't going to let him get the last laugh if she could help it. He looked around as if contemplating what additional damage he could do. He charged forward, jerking Tequila. She followed for a few steps, then splayed her feet and leaned back as hard as she could. I could feel her shoulders shake. "Hang in there, girl,"
I said. Maybe he'll head for the corral. Her quivering muscles told me her shoulders were sore, and she was having a hard time holding the bull. She couldn't dig in enough, and we had to give slack when he pulled. Desperation hovered around the scene. If I let the bull go, he could turn and charge Cole, or me, or run after the boys. None of us wanted to see an angry, horned, one-ton animal barreling toward him. I heard a motor sputtering behind me. I turned in the saddle enough to see Charlie Klaus coming up the levee on his old Popping Johnny, a 40-20 John Deere tractor with a front-end loader. He must have seen our predicament because he wheeled in through the gate and pulled up beside me. "Looks like the battle's in full swing," he shouted. "Can I help?" "Lord, I hope so. We're just about overmatched here." The bull stopped and turned to look at us, deciding whether to go forward or retrace his steps toward us. Charlie accelerated. He steered the tractor in front of Tequila and bumped that old bull none too gently. The bull wheeled around and took off straight toward the corral. Our convoy followed at high speed. Along the edge of the cotton field we went, then the alfalfa field. The bull stopped abruptly and looked back. Charlie was on him with the John Deere, and off the bull ran, not happy about being bumped again. The alfalfa field bordered the corral. "Tequila, we gotta get him in the corral." She pulled back a little, tightening the rope. The bull pulled to the right in response. If he kept on running, he'd go through the corral gate in less than a minute. Vince stood at the ready, both hands on the open gate. Cole hazed the bull on one side, and Charlie rode the tractor close on the other side. That big old red bull was running straight as an arrow. I unwound the dally and held the rope in my hand. The bull ran through the corral gate. I tossed the rope in behind him, and Vince slammed the gate shut. The bull stopped in the middle of the small corral. He swung his head in both directions, stomped around in a 180, and went to snorting and pawing. He was one pissed-off dude at having lost the battle. "Tequila, you get the Purple Heart," I said, patting her shoulder. I was so proud of the way she hung in there to the very end. If I'd known it was going to be such a huge chore, I wouldn't have subjected her to it. Every once in a while, I bit off more than I could chew, and this was one of those times. I dismounted and let the reins drop. She wasn't going anywhere. She was exhausted, sore, and used up. My heart went out to her. "You'll get extra grain tonight, sweetheart, after we get this bad boy home." I rubbed on her neck and nose. Charlie, Cole, Vince, and I spent the next quarter hour trying to get the bull up the loading chute into the trailer. We swung long sticks in front of him, yelled, did everything we could think of. If we had a red cape, we'd have stood at the top of the chute and waved it. But that gall darn animal stood his ground, flames jumping out of his eyes, looking for something to vent his fury on. When our frustration began to top out, Vince volunteered to do the insane. "I'll run across the corral," he said, like he had done it before a dozen times. "He's going to charge me, but just before I get to the chute, I'll jump for the fence. The bull run under me and up the chute. Problem solved." He shrugged his shoulders like it was no big deal. Vince was fast and young, but this was Mr. Macho he was talking about, stud of the bull kingdom. I said, "You sure you want to do that? I've seen this guy run, and you can be damn sure he'll give you a chase." Vince eyed his competitor. He gave another casual cowboy shrug that said risking his life was no big deal. "I can do it, boss. How else are we going to get him up that ramp?" standing there in the heat of a stalemate. I couldn't answer his question. Okay, I said, my glass of confidence only half full. But put some fire in those boots. Vince slipped around to the other side of the corral and climbed over the fence. He hit the ground running and yelling. He ran like a jackrabbit, but that bull's muscles were spring-loaded and ready to snap. He lurched into a run. Vince threw a hand and a foot on the fence. At the same time, the bull hiked his horns under Vince's butt. Vince went flying over the corral fence, head over tail. I winced. He thumped down on his back. The bull surveyed his work and clopped up the wooden chute into the trailer. Vince didn't move for a few moments. The wind in him had to be knocked from here to Lazy Bee. Cole hustled to secure the bull in the trailer, and Charlie and I jogged over to Vince, prepared to give first aid. Before we got to him, Vince stood up, wobbled a bit, and said with a grin, "Got that son of a bitch, didn't I?" "You practicing to be a rodeo clown?" said Charlie, slapping him on the back. I was just glad he was in one piece. Back at Lazy Bee, we unloaded the bull into his own corral, where he stomped around for the rest of the day. I led Tequila out of the trailer. She limped her way into the horse corral. "You stay here for a rest, girl. Eat some hay. Take it easy." I put a hand on each shoulder and rubbed. I didn't like to see her in pain. "I couldn't be more proud of you, Tequila. You gave me everything you had and never quit, even when it got down and dirty." She nosed my shirt. We left the bull in the corral. Every time I looked his way, he got pissed and made me understand that he was not the forgiving type. He had lost his way of life and wasn't going to enter rehab easily. Every few days, one of the cowboys would load hay in the pickup, drive into the corral, and get out to throw it in the feed manger. The bull would charge, and the cowboy would jump back in the truck. I made a judgment to never turn that animal out again. If we did and went to gather him, he might charge us or catch someone unaware and really do some damage. The following week, I loaded him into the trailer and hauled him to the livestock auction. He made a lot of hamburger for someone. Charlie told me who the kids were that owned the motorcycle. I called them and said, "If you can't fix your motorcycle, I'll buy you a new one." That's what I ended up doing. I gave Tequila a week in the corral and fed her extra hay. She walked around with a stiff gait, a sign of strained shoulder muscles. I thought it best to give her a long rest, so I turned her out for 6 months in the horse pasture, then brought her in, but she was still lame. Her shoulders had not healed right, and she walked with a limp. I felt twinges of sadness and regret every time I looked at her. She was still handsome and young, much too good a horse to sell. So I turned her out with her broodmates to raise colts, and she raised some really fine ones. And that was Roping the Bull. This is Witches, Wells, and Windmills. My dad was the resident well expert on the ranch. He knew more about wells, pumps, and windmills than anybody. When a pump or a windmill part had to be repaired, he was Johnny on the spot, tools in hand. He didn't trust anyone else to do the job as well as he could, and he probably was right. One time, Da sent Claude Tippetts to start a pump engine at Horse Camp. We desperately needed water in the tank. Claude left at 4 a.m. At noon, he still hadn't returned. At 3:00, Da decided he'd better find out what was going on. An hour later, he arrived at Horse Camp. There was Claude, still cranking on the bulky engine. He'd been cranking on it all day. It wasn't in Claude's nature to ever give up. "What's wrong, Claude?" "Ah, the damn motor won't run."
"Does it have gas?"
"Hell yes, Harry. You think I'm dumb?"
"Does it have spark?"
"Course it has spark."
"Dah said it should run then." He turned it over once, and that bulky engine fired and started running. It made Claude so angry that he quit his job right there on the spot and stormed off. My dad let him have a day or two to cool down, then went and begged him to come back to work, which Claude did. The one thing Dah did not like to do was climb the windmill towers, nor did any of the other cowboys. They would do it under duress and with protest. For some reason, I wasn't afraid of heights, so I became the tower monkey. When Dah slowed down, all maintenance and repair fell on my shoulders. Since water is the lifeblood of a ranch, I took the job seriously. Finding water on Lazy Bee could be a challenge. Under Dah's reign, first there would be talk of drilling. This might last a year or two. Then, after more discussion and what-ifs, he would choose the location. Next came the drilling. Plenty of dry holes were drilled over the decades. My dad occasionally would hire a dowser, also known as a water witch, to pinpoint the source of the water. For some folks, water witching is right up there with psychic predictions. I didn't necessarily believe in witching wells, but I strongly disliked drilling dry holes. Ralph Johnson, brother of cowboy Gene Johnson, claimed to have the power to find water and had a track record to prove it. No one in our family had the touch. We all tried, but to no avail. So when I wanted to dig a well, I called Ralph. Most dowsers use a forked peach tree branch. They walk along until the tip of the branch nosedives. That's where the water should be located. Ralph's technique was to take two welding rods and bend them at 90 degrees into an L shape. As he walked, he held them with the long part of the rods sticking out in front. When they crossed, he'd say that's where the water is, and even say how deep we had to dig to find it. I never understood how he could know the depth, and he never bothered to explain, but he was right more often than he was wrong. Once, some underground pipes sprang a leak. The fiddle farts who buried them hadn't left the treasure map of where to find them. Again, I called in Ralph. He located the pipeline within minutes, even tracked the bends in the pipe. Saved me a boatload of time and money. I hired Ralph at least 5 times to locate wells. In each case, we found water, and at the depth he predicted. After the wells were drilled and pumps and windmills installed, the upkeep began. One day, Cole and I were pulling the sucker rods out of one of our deepest wells. Cole drove the Jeep to pull a series of cables that lifted the rods so I could unbuckle each joint. I was unscrewing pieces of sucker rod, one after another. As I struggled with one of the joints, the wrench slipped out of my hand, flipped back, and landed on my middle finger. Laid it straight across the back of my hand. Broken bones punctured the skin. It was plain to see that I had a compound fracture. Cole suggested we go to the hospital. My first thought was no way. We were really low on water. The cattle needed us to finish the job. We forged ahead and pulled the rest of the rods, put new leathers on the pump, then put all 500 feet of rod back down in the well. I kept my finger out of the way as best as I could. When we finished, I acknowledged the pain in my finger. Cole insisted we go to the hospital, and this time I agreed. A physician's assistant was on duty. He cleaned up the wound, put the finger back so it pointed in the right direction, and set it in a splint. He asked me if I wanted pain pills.
I'm in some pain, I said, but I'd rather not take those pills. Do you like to drink beer? He asked. Yes, I've been known to drink beer. Well then, find yourself a bar and drink 3 or 4 beers, he said. Cole and I set out to pick up the prescription. We knew exactly where to stop, the 3-way bar between Duncan and Clifton. When I went into the bar to follow the doctor's orders, my hand was hurting something awful. I asked the bartender if she had a baggie, and she did, so I asked her to fill it with ice. I stuck my hand in the baggie, rubber banded it around my wrist, and started drinking with my other hand. About 20 minutes later, the bartender said, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. I was mystified. She said, you've run several of my customers off. How the hell did I do that? Look down at your hand. The bag of ice had turned cherry red. The blood had soaked through the bandages. I extended my apologies, and Cole and I skedaddled. It was the only time I've ever gotten kicked out of a bar. Altogether, we had 30 windmills on the ranch. Over time, we gradually substituted solar pumps for many of the windmills. Almost every day was sunshiny, but only some days did the wind blow, and solar pumps pumped more water than the windmills did. I refused, however, to take down the 2 windmills at headquarters. They were landmarks, and I took great pride in them. They sat on giant wooden towers, not steel like most of the other towers. Those 2 were in place by 1915 and still worked beautifully in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. No one else in the area had windmills that big. They were so big you could see them from 10 miles away. When I sold the ranch in 93, they were still able to pump water. When I returned a few years later, one of the windmills was gone. The new owners got so much grief for tearing it down, they went back to the collector who had bought it from them, bought it back, and hired someone to rebuild it. The last time I saw those 2 windmills, the fan blades were turning, but they weren't connected to the pump underground. You could hear them squeak and squawk as the weight of the pump changed from upstroke to downstroke. I still love those windmills. I visit Lazy Bee every now and then, and when I see those towers, I always feel like I've come home. That was Witches, Wells, and Windmills. Now we'll read Tailing Up Old Cows. One of the summer rituals at the ranch during most of my grade school years was tailing up old, thin cows. Ranching in those days was a lot more primitive, and ranchers didn't care for their cattle's health as well as they did in later years when they routinely bought supplemented feed. About every other year, we'd have a dry spring, and if we'd had no winter moisture, the plants wouldn't green up. Since the nutritional value of the previous year's growth was very low, some of our older cows would get so thin that they would be close to death. If Rastus found them in that state, he would slowly drive them back to headquarters, where we would feed them hay and nutritious feed. Some of those old cows would get so weak that if they lay down, they wouldn't have enough strength to get up again to eat or drink. In that case, a group of 3 cowboys went morning and evening to tail up the old cows. 2 cowboys would put a rope under the cow's chest, then got on either side of her. The 3rd cowboy, usually the strongest, would get behind the cow and wrap her tail around his neck and hold on to the bush of the tail. They would all crouch down, and on the count of 3 gave a mighty effort to pick up this 600-pound cow and get her on her feet. The cowboys made fun of the guy at the back end, because quite often the tail was covered with poop, and he'd have a brown ring around his neck after he'd tailed up a bunch of cows.
it was not a badge of honor. If the cow had a will to live, she would stay standing and happily munch on her hay and drink water, her tail still having enough kick to swat flies. Some of the cows lost their will to live and wouldn't put any effort into standing. The cowboys would try again and again to stand them up and get them to support their own weight, but those cows just wanted to stay at ground level. The rule of thumb was that if a cow refused to stand, she'd probably die within a short period of time, even a couple of days. The interesting part was that some of the cows seemed grateful for the help they received in getting up, but at least half the old cows were angry. Once they got standing, they'd try to run around and charge their helpers. When they did, they usually fell back down. So the cowboys would pick them up again, hopefully get them interested in eating the hay and taking a drink so that they could quietly and quickly slide away. How many did we save? Maybe 50%. It was always a happy time when an old cow regained her strength, got off the good feed, and didn't need help anymore. Often my dad waited too long to save a cow. A lot of old cows wear their teeth off and then get thin. They should be sold before that happens. "That old cow has made a good mother and might have one more good calf," he would say when he should have been selling her. She got a reprieve from being sold. When I was about 5, I wanted to be part of the tailing up process. I would take a flake of hay to the cow and put it right in front of her. We'd all feel good if she ate it. The angry cows, though, would charge me, try to butt me and knock me down. It's a frightening thing when you're not much more than knee-high, and you see a 600-pound cow with blood in her eye wanting to trample you. But I was determined to do what the cowboys did. One of the scariest times I had happened one day when the cowboys tailed up a cow that was getting a lot better and a lot stronger and was almost ready to be released from the hospital pen. She was strong enough to help the cowboys lift her, and as soon as she got on her feet, she charged forward. At that moment, I was walking into the corral with hay in my arms, a double armful of hay. That cow saw me, and here she came, running right at me. I dropped the hay and turned to run, but she was the faster of us. I ran lickety-split, as fast as my 5-year-old legs could go. I kept running. I looked back over my shoulder, and she was about a foot away. I kept running, then put my hand back. Her head was right there. My hand was on her face, and she was running and pushing me forward. I could feel her blowing snot on me. I think I ran the fastest I ever ran in my life, because I was literally running for my life. I thought the end was near. The cowboys were leaning against the fence, yelling, "Run, Alan, run!" She finally stopped. I kept running out of pure fright. I was so frightened, I had to leave the corral and sit down and collect my wits. I was glad to have escaped unharmed. When I got to managing the ranch, I made it a rule that I would never let a cow become thin enough to have to be tailed up. I tried to grow more grass for the cattle. I tried to cull the cattle more accurately. Fortunately, the scene was never repeated. No cattle charged. No cowboys ran. I was glad when that part of history became history. And the badge of honor? Well, it made itself known in other ways. And that was Tailing Up Old Cows. This is simply entitled Blondie. My partner in the Nebraska ranch, Alan Stratman, unexpectedly showed up one Saturday at Lazy Bee headquarters pulling a horse trailer behind his pickup. He had driven the 3 hours from Sonoyta, Arizona, where he lived. I was in the house and saw him drive up and walked out to greet him. my 8-year-old daughter Sarah, who'd been playing nearby, and her dog Boots, joined me.
"Hey, Al, how you doing? I brought you and Sarah here a little something."
Stratman opened the trailer door and backed out a quarter-horse Palomino mare. She was tall, about 15 and a half hands, sleek, and beautifully put together, with an intelligent head.
"Meet Blondie," he said, holding the lead rope out to Sarah. "She's about to move in with you."
Sarah looked at me as if I could explain what was happening here. I had no clue, so answered with the same quizzical look. Sarah took the rope.
"Hey, Blondie."
Blondie lifted her head in quick acknowledgement, then turned to check out her new surroundings. Stratman explained that he had bought Blondie 6 months ago. She came from a lineage of top-notch quarter horses. He had been trying to break her since.
"But she's so hard-headed, I've had next to no luck breaking her," he said. "Yesterday, I got to thinking that she just might be better off with a female trainer."
He put a hand on Sarah's shoulder.
"You're the finest young horsewoman I've ever seen, and I think she belongs with you."
Sarah's eyes widened. "Do you want me to train her for you?"
"Nope. She's yours. I give her to you, and I wish you better luck than what I've had with her."
Sarah looked as if she had been handed the biggest and best Christmas present from under the tree. Blondie looked down her muzzle at the small, pigtailed creature bouncing on the tips of her tennies. With that and a brief visit, Santa Claus drove off into the horizon, a cloud of magical dust in his wake. We stood there, awestruck, rubbing on our newest family member. Sarah already had the look of love.
"Go on," I said. "Get your boots. Let's see what this girl has to offer."
Stratman was right. Blondie could be a real butthead. Sarah wanted to train her to be a jumper because she loved horse jumping and the competition it offered. But that rebel of a mare had her own ideas about how the world works. She'd grab the bit in her teeth and cold jaw, then run off with Sarah, refusing to do what Sarah wanted. More than once, Blondie threw her head up and hit Sarah right in the face and hurt her. But Sarah never cried. In fact, Blondie couldn't do anything to make Sarah fear her or abandon the task of breaking her. One day, I came in from work and saw Sarah on Blondie. I went over to the corral to check on her.
"Dad, when I want her to gallop, she wants to buck. Here, watch."
Sarah spurred Blondie, and that horse went to bucking across the corral. I couldn't do a thing but watch and be ready to scoop up Sarah if she flew off. Halfway across the corral, Sarah looked back at me, grinning.
"Look, Dad, isn't she cute?"
It was one female will against another, and Sarah was determined to win. Another day, I noticed the two of them in the jumping arena.
"How's it going, Sarah?"
"Dad, I can get Blondie to jump the regular jumps with the poles across, but not the roll top."
They must have been working at it for a while, because she sounded frustrated. The roll top was solid and wide, but only 3 feet high, the same height as the pole jumps Blondie already cleared.
"Can you help me?"
"Run her at it and show me what she does."
Sarah rode straight at the jump. Blondie stopped right in front of it. The next time, Blondie veered right. Every time Sarah tried to jump her over the roll top, Blondie refused.
I had an idea.
I hauled over 2 corral panels from the shed and set one at either end of the roll top at an angle, creating a V to prevent Blondie from veering. It didn't take that horse more than a few runs to figure out that she could turn in front of the panels. If Sarah managed to get her inside the wings, Blondie stopped at the roll top and refused to jump. Sarah tried this and that, all to no avail. The frustration factor was beginning to multiply. Without saying anything to Sarah, I picked up a piece of old plastic pipe lying on the ground and got in position near the jump. Sarah lined up Blondie and started riding her. The second Blondie started to stop, I swatted her a good one right across the hips. Blondie jumped about 20 feet forward, but not over the roll top. Sarah landed behind the saddle, but didn't fall off.
"Dad, what are you doing? Don't hurt my horse."
"I'm not hurting her," I said. "I wanted to see if I could change her mind. This is a test of wills. Your will says one thing, and hers says another."
"But that's not the way to do it," said Sarah.
She scrambled back in the saddle, adding some further tongue lashes. We worked with Blondie for a while longer without success. By this time, all of us had lost our temper. Blondie had her head set in every direction but over the jump. Sarah was angry with Blondie, but angrier with me, and I was angry with Blondie for being so stubborn. We were locked up in a box of frustration with no productive place to go. I pushed my mind out of the box, breathed in some fresh air, and did some thinking. Sarah tried to jump again. Blondie stopped short again. "Is Squaw in the corral?" I asked. Squaw was Sarah's other horse.
"Yes," said Sarah.
"Go get her. I'll stand here and hold Blondie. When you get back, I want you to take the roll top with Squaw. I'm going to have Blondie watch you jump."
Sarah stuck out her chin.
"That's a dumb idea. Blondie's not going to jump just by watching another horse do it."
"Sarah, you have a better idea. We're all angry, and we're up against the wall here. I don't have another idea, but if you have one, now's the time to lay it out. Otherwise, go get Squaw and let's try it. I agree it probably won't work, but maybe it will give us time to cool off."
Sarah rolled her eyes, dismounted, and huffed off to get Squaw. She returned to the arena, leading Squaw with Boots the dog in tow. Wherever Sarah and Squaw went, Boots went, so Sarah, Squaw, and Boots all took the roll top.
"Now turn around and jump it coming the other way."
"This is stupid," Sarah muttered.
"Yeah, it probably is," I thought, but I didn't admit it out loud. The threesome prepared to jump. I squeezed Blondie's halter and forced her head in Sarah's direction.
"Now you pay attention to this, you hard-headed bitch. Look how Squaw jumps."
No response from Blondie.
"Do it again," I said.
Sarah, Squaw, and Boots jumped four more times each way. I kept a tight grip on Blondie and told her each time to pay attention. She quietly stood her ground.
"Let's try Blondie now."
Sarah rode Squaw over and swapped lead ropes with me.
"Boots, stay here," I said.
The three of us watched as Sarah and Blondie readied and started toward the jump. When Blondie came to the roll top, she shifted her weight onto her back legs and pushed off the ground. She cleared that jump like she had done it 100 times before. Sarah quickly turned her and jumped her the other direction, just to make sure it wasn't a fluke. She jumped her again and again. Boots and I joined Sarah and Blondie for a little congratulatory hoopla. The switch had flipped in Blondie, and with that flip came the Pledge of Allegiance. From that day forward, Blondie acquiesced to Sarah's every bidding, and not just with jumping. Blondie was eager to read Sarah's mind, and did just that as often as possible. She and Sarah went on to win so many shows that I lost count. And that was Blondie. and we've been reading from Cowboy Up, Life Lessons from Lazy Bee by H. Allen Day. Thank you for joining us again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up a cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.